Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about the changing demographics of Christianity around the world. And our guest is Philip Jenkins. He's a scholar who's interested in the study of global Christianity and of new and emerging religious movements. He is Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies and History at Penn State and is the author of a number of books, including one that we'll be talking about this morning, and that is The Next Christendom, The Coming of Global Christianity. This is a book that was first published in 2002, and this year has been published in a revised and expanded edition. It's published by the Oxford University Press, is available in a paperback if you would like to read the book. And in this book, Professor Jenkins, that over the last 500 years, the story of Christianity has been bound up with the story of Europe and its descendants. But over the past century, he says, the center of gravity in the Christian world has shifted to Africa and Latin America. And in fact, if the demographic trends that we have seen continue, in less than 20 years from now, there will be more Christians in Africa and in Latin America than in Europe. He says, among other things, he says, this should make us very careful before making sweeping statements about what Christians believe, because these demographic changes have also had important effects on both theology and religious practice. We'll try and talk about some of the ideas that you will find in the next Christendom this morning as we talk with Philip Jenkins. And of course, questions and comments from people who are listening are welcome. He is the author of a number of books, one that we discussed not very long ago on this program, a book titled Dream Catchers, How Mainstream America Discovered Native Spirituality. His other books include The New Anti-Catholicism and The New Faces of Christianity, Believing the Bible in the Global South, and also what I think is the most recent book, which is titled God's Continent, Christianity, Islam, and Europe's Religious Crisis, and that's published by the Oxford University Press. I'm sure that you can head down to the bookstore or the library and look for some of his books if you'd like to read them. Questions here on the program are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you can give us a call. Professor Jenkins, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. To begin, maybe you could talk a little bit about numbers, and perhaps talk a little bit about right now how the numbers of Christians stack up in Europe and the European world. So I guess that would probably also include the United States, but make some comparisons between Europe and Africa and Latin America now.
Right. Well, 100 years ago, the vast majority of the world's Christians lived in Europe and in North America. That situation has changed very fast. Around the world today, there are probably some 2 billion Christians, and the largest single segment of those still live in Europe with, say, 500 and some million. Latin America is close behind, and Africa is third. But things are changing very fast, and by 2025, Africa and Latin America will be in competition for the title of the most Christian continent. And as we move further down the road towards 2050, there's really no doubt that, as I might say, Africa wins. Christianity, at least in terms of numbers, increasingly becomes a religion of Africa and the African diaspora overseas. Mm-hmm. There will still be a lot of Christians in Europe, and maybe we can talk about that later, but they will be really heavily outnumbered by people from the global south, which is a phrase that people use to mean Africa, Asia, Latin America.
So the face of world Christianity is changing and will change in a significant way, and in also a very literal way it will change.
Right. As I say in my book, I mean, if you want to think of a typical Christian in the world today, then don't think of an American or a European. Think of a woman, more likely, living near the equator, living in a village in Nigeria or a shanty town in Brazil, or in Manila. That would be a typical Christian right now. And as you move further towards the middle of this coming century, that becomes even more true.
The rate of growth of Christianity in Africa, particularly, I think also in Latin America, between, roughly speaking, between 1900 and the year 2000 was very significant, was very dramatic. Now, it was my understanding that when you first published The Next Christendom in 2002, it was the trend, people had noted the trend, although it had been kind of dismissed. And when this book was first published, it was the first time that I think a lot of people actually started to take notice, given the fact that the rate of growth was as dramatic as it was. Why was it, do you think, that this is something that apparently other scholars who tracked this phenomenon tended to dismiss and say, well, this really isn't all that important. It's not worth our spending time studying.
Right. It wasn't so much that scholars didn't pay attention to it, because they knew it perfectly well. It's just that it didn't get picked up in the media or serious journalism. Partly because I think it ran across what people believed. People right up until, I suppose, the early part of this decade tended to believe that when they looked at Africa and Asia, that the default religion of those continents was Islam. And that when you found Christianity there, it was associated with white missionaries. So that when white empires ended in Africa and Asia, presumably Christianity ended with it. In fact, it was rather the reverse. Christianity accelerated in growth when the empires died. And, some of those numbers are amazing. I mean, I cite Africa, which back in 1900 had 10 million Christians, about 10% of the population. By 2000, that 10 million had grown to 360 million, and it was just under half the population, which is, in pure quantitative terms, the largest religious change that's ever occurred anywhere. So the numbers are pretty substantial.
Yeah. How much of this can be traced to simple demographics, that is, that the rate of population increase in Africa and Latin America is much higher than it is in Europe and the United States?
A large part of the story is demographic. I look at a country like Uganda, for example. Back in 1950, there were 5 million Ugandans. Today, there's probably around 25 million. And by the middle of this coming century, there could be, who knows, maybe 60 million. If you assume that Christians remain steady as a proportion of that population, at say three-quarters, which is a reasonable guess, then that means that the number of Christians, the absolute number of Christians, rises from something like 4 million to 20 million just since 1950. Africa really stands out from other parts of the world because it retains a very high population growth rate, which these days you don't even find so much in Latin America. Latin American growth rates are slowing down a lot, but Africa, and therefore Africa's Christian population, really stand out in the world.
Does the, in addition to the fact that there are these demographic trends, though, is there something about Christians in the developing world, their inclination to seek converts, and perhaps the commitment they have to their faith, does that play some kind of role?
Oh, sure. If you think of what's happened in much of the global south over the last, say, 40 years, you've had a number of great trends. You've had, urbanization above all. We live in one of the great ages of urbanization in human history. When people move from villages into cities, they're moving into communities where all the traditional supports, all the traditional means of getting by have collapsed. There are really no means of obtaining health, welfare, education, except what people supply for themselves or they obtain from religious institutions. And in Muslim countries, that means Islam, often of a quite fundamentalist kind. And in Christian communities, it means churches. And so the churches that supply those needs have grown very fast. Churches are the means by which ordinary people survive in these great cities that in many cases have grown from, say, 500,000 people to 10 million people over 40 years, and in which government is absent. That does a lot to condition the kind of Christianity which grows, which has a strong emphasis on healing, miracle, maybe in large parts of Africa today, the only way to survive is by miracle.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Philip Jenkins. He is professor of religious studies and history at Pennsylvania State University, has written a lot about Christianity around the world, is the author of a book, The Next Christendom, The Coming of Global Christianity, that looks at changes in the demographics of Christianity around the world. This is a book that was first published in 2002 and now is out in a revised and expanded edition. It's published by the Oxford University Press. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore or the library if you'd like to read it. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that there's a very interesting and very important point here that you make, and I'd like to have you talk about it, that is that people need to remember to consider that when Christianity moved into Northern Europe from the Mediterranean, the Middle East, where it started, it was reshaped by the values of the people who took it on. And that the same thing has already happened in Africa and Latin America. In what way is, and I think perhaps you've already touched on it a little bit, but in what way is the practice of Christianity in Africa and Latin America, and particularly in Africa, different from the practice of Christianity in Europe?
The difference is not so much in the kinds of Christianity that you find, but the kinds which are mainstream. So, for instance, if you go to Europe, if you go to North America, you find a very wide range of types of Christianity, and some of them are very oriented to healing, miracle, if you like, visions and trances and prophecy. And we think of Pentecostal churches, and they certainly exist in the northern world, but they're not the mainstream. In Africa, they absolutely are the mainstream, and that's also true whether you're looking at what we would call mainstream churches, Catholic, Lutheran, Anglican, or Episcopalian, all have this very charismatic style. I come back to this idea of healing, of spiritual healing, which is so central to the religious practice. And some people would look at that and say that that's a survival of old pagan times. But what an African Christian would say is, we have a very good warrant for this. We just look in our Bible, we look in at what people did, what the apostles did in the book of Acts, and they did exactly these things. So why do people say this is somehow pagan?
I think this is very interesting, that it seems to me that you could make the argument that, in a sense, the lives of these people that we're talking about, Africans and people in Latin America, are, if you look at their daily experience, their lives may indeed be much closer to the lives of the people of the Bible than ours are. So in a sense, rather than saying, as you say, rather than taking Christianity and somehow grafting it onto a set of beliefs that they already have, when they read their Bible, they read the stories of the people in the Old Testament, particularly, they can identify with that because that's the way that their life is difficult. It is harsh. Death is really never all that far away. So you could see it where they would read those stories and say, well, of course that's the way life is like. That's the way my life is like. You wouldn't have to sell that.
Right, and you know, I've often had the experience of talking to African people about this, and they will often point to passages which they say, you know, speak to them as an immediate thing. And just to take a small thing, the idea of going along to the marketplace in the morning and meeting a magician, meeting somebody who has a possessed medium who will tell your fortune or speak. I mean, there's a story like that in the book of Acts, and it happens in, you know, as an everyday thing in many parts of Africa. Many parts of Africa and Asia are not that far away from the concept of famine, which plays such a strong part in shaping the stories of the Bible. In fact, this almost reverses the role of the Old Testament as we find it for Americans. Many Americans think that the Old Testament is such a distant text, it just tells the story of such a strange alien world, that it's hardly relevant to them. The problem in Africa is the other way around. It's getting them to take the New Testament as seriously as the Old. because the Old Testament is their world. They may not live in worlds in which they practice nomadism or polygamy or blood sacrifice, but they know that you don't have to go far up the road or too far back in time to find a society in which those were normal customs and practices. The Old Testament world is a few decades away.
Protestant evangelicals and Pentecostals have been particularly successful in conversions in the southern world, the developing world, the world that we're talking about. And it's interesting that that has happened also in places, and here I'm thinking about Latin America, in places where previously Roman Catholicism had been the dominant form of Christianity. Why is it that very conservative, evangelical, Protestant Christians have been so successful?
Well, you know, it's actually been across the board. One of the statistics I always enjoy is what happened to Catholics in Africa during the 20th century, where their growth rate between 1900 and 2000 was 6,700%, which is one of those statistics which is kind of impressive. So it really is a rising tide lifts all boats. But Pentecostals, as you say, have done particularly well because of the way they've packaged Christianity, the way that they've presented Christianity in a way in which people can worship enthusiastically in a very charismatic style. They focus on ideas of healing. But, you know, the other thing that's very interesting is the social revolution the churches like that have unleashed. In traditional societies, the right to speak in public, the right to political action is very often confined to older people, and particularly older men. In Pentecostal churches, that kind of power is open to anyone with access to spiritual authority, and that might mean teenagers, young adults, and women. So women play an absolutely critical role in these churches across Asia, Africa, and Latin America.
One of the points that you make it here is that overall, when you look at the church, the Christian church in Africa, Latin America, you see a church that is in beliefs and in moral teaching, generally speaking, more conservative than the church of the developed world, and that this naturally creates some potential for conflict between now these two branches of the church. And one area in which we have already seen dramatic conflict has to do with homosexuality and the question of whether or not active gay people can be ordained. This is something there has been quite dramatic dispute.
Right.
Involving particularly African Catholics, I think, and European and American Catholics, to the point where one begins to wonder whether there's some possibility of schism over an issue like this.
Right. Where that's been most obvious in the last couple of years has been in the Anglican Communion, which includes the U.S. Episcopal Church. A few years ago, of course, the U.S. Episcopal Church ordained an actively gay bishop, Gene Robinson. And that created real shock and horror for many conservative African and Asian churches who, well, to cut a long story short, at the moment it is quite likely that the U.S. Episcopal Church and possibly its Canadian counterpart will be thrown out of the Anglican Communion by the mainstream of that church, which is African and Asian, who have gone so far as to say that what the Americans and the Canadians are doing isn't just wrong, it's just not a violation of Christianity, that they are defining the Episcopal Church, for example, as no longer within the Christian fold. So things have moved along very fast. And conflicts like that are happening or are about to happen in several other denominations, including Methodists and Presbyterians, where you have much more conservative people in the global south who are very unhappy with policies about morality and sexuality in the north. I emphasize they're not conservative on everything, and on economic matters they might be quite liberal, quite progressive, but this sexual division is really marked.
Is that the only, or is that the main area of conflict around human sexuality? Or are there other things that have the potential to be that divisive?
That is overwhelmingly the largest, because with many other things, for example, should women be ordained as priests or clergy, there's a great deal of what you might call wiggle room in terms of the scriptures. So you can argue that you can do these things, and in fact, a number of African churches are quite happy ordaining women. But homosexuality, as it's understood, seems to be a simple yes-no question. The scriptures say repeatedly that this is wrong, and that you cannot get around this without going explicitly against the scriptures, so that when Americans or Europeans say that you can do this, Africans say, no, this is where we have to draw a line. So I don't think other issues really come close to that.
We're getting close to the midpoint of this conversation. Let me just again very quickly introduce again the guest, Philip Jenkins. He is Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies and History at Penn State and is the author of a number of books about Christianity, global Christianity, about its study. That's a particular area of interest of his. Also, new and emerging religious movements. He has authored a number of books, and this one, The Next Christendom, is that we're talking about here, is just one of them. This is the book that's now been republished in a revised and expanded edition just this year. It was first published in 2002. So if you're interested, The Next Christendom, The Coming of Global Christianity, published by Oxford University Press. You can also look for some of his other books as well. Questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You've talked about the fact that now that there is this very strong emerging, perhaps already has emerged, Christianity in Latin America and in Africa. And we talked about the way the numbers are going, and we've talked about here particularly about conflict over one issue, one big issue, human sexuality, causing a kind of a split, perhaps a split between Christians in Africa and Christians in the United States and Canada, and perhaps also in Britain. So we have independent churches, individual churches in Africa and Latin America. Then we have these two big continents. To what extent have the leaders of these individual congregations and of these regions come together so that one could say that there's a movement in the sense that leaders get together, they talk about common interests, they perhaps think about the fact that they could have a great deal of, would have a great deal of power if all of their followers were mobilized. Has that kind of thing been going on?
Not really, except within particular denominations. So the example would be within the Anglican Communion, for example, conservative African and Asian primates, who are the senior leaders of the church, have met. You also have regional conferences of leaders within the Roman Catholic Church, but as yet there never has been something like a meeting of all different African denominations or Asian denominations. I wouldn't expect that, at least for the foreseeable future, because people are still focused on these denominational loyalties. They still care about those.
Just as a kind of a side question, one of the points that you raise, just as in a sense as a question, I'm not sure that it has an answer. You can tell me whether it has an answer. We've talked about this dramatic growth, particularly over about the last century, of Christianity, Africa and Latin America. Still the numbers of Christians in Asia, relatively small, certainly not like the numbers in the rest of the world. Why is that?
You know, that's a matter for huge debate. And if you look at, for instance, the Roman Catholic Church, still, the Philippines is one of the world's largest Catholic countries. There are more Catholic baptisms in the Philippines in a typical year than in France, Spain, Italy, and Poland combined. So there are a lot of Asian Catholics. They're in the Philippines, they're in Vietnam. There are a couple of places on the map that you can think of as giant question marks, and the biggest of those is China. I don't know how many Christians there are in China. Some people say there are 50 million, and that's the fairly conservative figure that I take. Some people say there's 100 million. But whichever of those figures you take, that still means that China is already one of the world's largest Christian countries and seems to be set to become more so in the future. India probably also has 40 million Christians. So there are a lot of Asian Christians. The difference from Africa is that they are in a much larger overall population, so they will always be a significant minority, whereas in Africa they stand a chance to be major, really substantial majorities. But countries like China and India and Vietnam are very interesting, very very puzzling countries for numbers, but significant forces.
Mm. And we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that as Christianity spread out from the Middle East to the Mediterranean to Northern Europe, it changed in a sense. It changed because the peoples that took it on, they didn't cast off their own values and their own worldview in a sense that they melded. We talked about the fact that perhaps people in the developing world, their daily life experience was so much like the experience, particularly of people of the Old Testament, that it was very natural that they should identify with those stories because it was so much like what their life and their world actually was. So there's always this potential for the faith, in a sense, practice, to beliefs to change somewhat, maybe not in the most fundamental ways, but to change somewhat. So now it comes to the question: if now this kind of Christianity has become powerful in the developing world, and the numbers get to the point where we have more Christians in Africa and Latin America than in Europe, then do we come to a point where their priorities, their beliefs, start to feed back and start to have an impact on, perhaps influence the practice of Christianity in the developed world?
Well, you know, that's already happening in a lot of ways, and the great example I would choose of that would be the world's largest Christian organization is the Roman Catholic Church, which probably is already 70% in the global south, and that number will grow dramatically over time. When Americans and Europeans look at the papacy over the last 20, 25 years, they think how very conservative it is, how very out of step. But of course, the answer is it's out of step with the United States or France or Germany. It is not out of step with the global south. The one reason the papacy is so conservative, or has been under John Paul II and Benedict, is because the papacy pays attention to sentiments in the global south. So when Americans say, you know, that what the papacy says it does not go down in Boston or Chicago, well, the answer is it goes down fine in Manila or Kinshasa or these other, or Lagos or these other great Christian centers. So already we're seeing that sort of change. The other thing is that a lot of global south churches have got major missionary ventures in the global north. Anywhere you go in America, you can find Korean, Brazilian, Nigerian missionaries, certainly in the big cities, and that'll grow over the coming years. So the change you're talking about, I think, already has happened to some extent.
I have a caller here. Just real quick, we had an off-the-air question, and it's probably good for a point of clarity.
Sure.
Someone was wondering, when we're talking about Christians, we're talking about all Christians, including Protestants and Catholics.
Protestants and Catholics and Orthodox, yes.
But it's also true that if you, I think that it's true, if you look at where the great growth has been, it has been among Protestants. Is that true?
No, I don't think that's right. And I cited the example of Roman Catholics in Africa. Back in 1900, I think very approximately there were 2 million Catholics in Africa, and today there's something like 150 million.
Oh, okay.
That's a major growth. So as I say, a rising tide really raises all boats. So it's not just Protestant. Certainly the groups that have grown most spectacularly have been Pentecostal or Charismatic, don't forget the Catholics as well.
Well, that's good to go back to that point, because I guess in my mind I was thinking about particularly about the fact that in the success of conservative evangelical Protestants in the developing world, something that has gotten some attention. It has been written about in mainstream media. So perhaps in my mind I have this idea that their growth has outpaced that of Catholics, and I guess that's really not true.
No, I don't think so. And that's one reason, by the way, where there's a lot of competition in many parts of the world between Protestants and Catholics, particularly in Latin America, and certainly in Latin America, Protestants have grown much faster than Catholics. You know, countries like Brazil, they probably now make up 15% of the population. But if you look elsewhere in the world, in India and China and Korea, Catholics are doing pretty well. So it's a pretty broad picture.
All right, let's talk with someone in Champaign. This would be line number one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Some people would suggest that the first theological tradition to emerge from the global south was liberation theology. Would the trends that you've been talking about suggest that its eclipse is temporary, and that we will in fact hear a good deal more of liberation theology from the growing numbers of Christians in the third world?
The only way in which I would disagree with that is to say that if you look, of course, far back in history, a lot of other ideas come from the global south. A lot of Christianity in the Middle Ages, for example, comes from what today we'd call the Middle East, from North Africa. You know, there are Syrian, there are African popes. But, you know, certainly in modern times, yeah, liberation theology was very important. It remains open to question just how eclipsed it has been. If you look in large sections of Africa, and you look at some of the bishops and archbishops who oppose tyrannical governments like in Zimbabwe, then they use exactly the same kind of texts as the liberation theologians always did. The only kind of distinction I would make is that in the global south, liberation theology always goes hand in hand with the idea of deliverance. In other words, you can't just have political liberation, you also have this spiritual warfare going along with it. So if you ask a Christian in the global south, their aim is to cast out tyrants and to cast out demons, and the two things go hand in hand. So liberation ideas in that broad sense are, I think, are very much alive, and they will continue to be so.
Liberation theology was always associated, too, with institutional innovations in the 20th century global south. I'm thinking particularly of the base communities and so forth out of which it grew. These were pretty seriously attacked in a lot of countries in Africa and Latin America, so much so that some people say that the Reagan wars in Central America of the 1980s was really a war on the Catholic Church in these new institutional forms. What do you see happening to them?
You know, these the base communities, they remain very important in countries like Brazil. The problem they've experienced, though, is that many of the people who used to follow them moved over to Pentecostal churches, not because those Pentecostal churches were politically conservative. In fact, they were, you know, very often led by women, by people of color, but because they offered a fuller package. They offered ideas of empowerment, but together with these ideas of spiritual deliverance and healing. And, you know, I quote one person in my book who's talking about Brazil, who says the Catholic Church opted for the poor, but the poor opted for the Pentecostals, which is kind of interesting. So I would see some of the Pentecostal churches as the heirs the inheritors of that kind of base community idea.
I've had the impression that Harvey Cox has written about this at some length, sees this as a transformation, indeed, of both traditions, not so much a migration from Catholic to Protestant, but a transformation of liberation theological groups in the Catholic tradition, as well as the empowerment of these Protestant, of these Pentecostalist groups.
It's a fair comment, except that in numbers, it's really the Pentecostal churches that are doing so very well. So yes, indeed, both sides are growing, but it really is the Pentecostals who are doing much better. And you know, I point to Brazil, which by some standards will be the world's second largest Christian country in a few years, where the number of people who declare themselves Catholics of all kinds is now down to about 70%, whereas Protestants are up to 15%. And that trend really is moving along. By 2050, maybe it'll be 50-50 Protestant Catholic. So the Pentecostals really are doing a lot better than the liberation theologians. The idea of liberation theology is still very much alive, but it really has been transformed in that way.
If they're the second, who's the first?
I'm sorry?
If Brazil is second largest, what's the first?
Oh, the United States.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No, the United States would be at the top of the list, followed by, Brazil, Mexico, and Nigeria, the Philippines, very much global south countries.
All right. Let's go to line number two. This is someone in Champaign County. Hello.
Hi. I was already planning on calling. The idea of liberation theology does impinge on what I was going to ask about, and it's got to do with the Eurocentric vision of the current Bishop of Rome. And it seems his latest book, I've only examined one chapter, but from the analysis I'm hearing about it, is one of the things he's trying to do is to make sure that Christ isn't seen as a rebel, that he's not preoccupied with justice in the earthly kingdom as opposed to rather the other kingdom afterwards. And obviously, that's the reaction to liberation theology, that even though it may be not so healthy now, it still needs to have a stake driven in it, apparently. But there was a lot of call for a pope from the South in the lead up to this. And from your point of view, I'm critical of the whole phenomenon myself, and I hope you won't accuse me of being a new anti-Catholic bastion, but it seems to me that just putting political change into the religious context ties it up in some ways. In some places, it's the only way it can show up, though, obviously, mm-hmm. because of repression, and there is a bit of a sanctuary,
sure.
particularly illustrated by the aforementioned wars in Central America, where, of course, you know, we were so concerned during the Reagan era of the Polish Pope, who was being brutalized by one general in Poland, that there were thousands of Catholics and clergy and otherwise being killed in Central America by Arminians. So, over to you.
Boy, I don't know where to start. It is interesting about the idea of a pope from the third world. In a sense, and you know, please listen carefully to what I'm going to say here, Pope John Paul was the first pope from the global south. And what I mean by that was he was elected specifically because Latin American and African cardinals said they would no longer accept an Italian, and there had to be something to move outside that old mold. And the pole was the first step. So already that was becoming a force back as early as 1978, which is kind of interesting. Benedict actually said something which was very interesting when he did that talk last year at Regensburg about the, and he got a lot of quotes for his remarks on Muhammad, but he said something more interesting. He was still saying that Christianity had to be understood in the context of Greek philosophy. And in some ways, that's a very, very controversial idea, because there are people in China or Japan or the Philippines, for example, who say, no, Christianity is universal. You have to be able to understand it in terms of Asian philosophy, Asian approaches. Africans say you have to put it in African thought, African language. So you may be right in saying that he is very determined to maintain a European approach, and probably he won't be able to do it for much longer. I sometimes think he may be the last European pope we will see for many decades. So you can see him as a little bit of a rear guard in that way. In fairness, you know, certainly he's spoken out against liberation theology, but also the Catholic authorities remain very strong on human rights in many countries in, you know, across the global south.
Yeah, in word, I think less indeed, and that's a Catholic sin of omission, it seems to me. But
boy, you know, I look, for instance, at Zimbabwe, where, you know, opposition can get you killed, and the person who speaks out and risks his life on a fairly daily basis is this guy, Archbishop Anube, from Bulawayo. You know, admittedly, he's not picking up a rifle, but he is the only person who is able to speak out and can do so without getting killed. So, you know, all credit to him on something like that.
Well, where were they 20 years ago when they should have been insisting on land reform being redeemed from the Lancaster House records at that time? And the Pope from the Third World, as you called the previous one, actually instituted a voting policy that is probably going to entrench the European control for some number past Benedict, but that's not entirely thought out. But I think it's probably.
Of course, he also basically doubled the number of cardinals from the global south and the number of voting cardinals. And as I understand it, Benedict is will be continuing that that trend. It took a long time for the number of cardinals to reflect reality. And you know, if you want to talk about Africa, for example, you know, the Catholics together with the other churches played a very significant role in South Africa.
We have just about 5 minutes left. I want to just very quickly again introduce our guest, Philip Jenkins. He is Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies and History at Penn State, is interested in the study of global Christianity, of new and emerging religious movements. We're talking about the changing demographics of Christianity around the world. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that there was at one point when people thought that as Europe's hold on the developing world loosened, as we moved out of the colonial era, that Christianity would fade and that the default religion would be Islam, and that in fact that has not happened. But I think that given though that reality, that there are still people who are concerned about the potential for conflict between Christianity and Islam, at least around the issue of spreading the word and seeking converts. Do you see that there is potential for that kind of conflict?
Well, I think it goes beyond potential. I mean, we're really seeing a lot of that conflict around the world today, in, you know, Nigeria, the Sudan, Indonesia, and many other countries. So there is that conflict. Partly that is a function of Christian growth in countries of West Africa, for instance. Muslims have been there for a long time. They'd always regarded it as basically their territory. They thought there was some pagans on the fringes of society, but they were nothing to worry about. And then suddenly in the 20th century, all these pagans became part of the world religion of Christianity and were growing so fast that they threatened to be converting Muslims. So some of the violence on both sides is defensive. I mean, just to put this in context, there's one province I know in Nigeria called Plateau Province, and in between 2000 and 2005, the number of people who were killed or expelled from there in interreligious violence totaled 50,000. And we probably had a couple of million killed in the Sudan over the last 30 years. So there was a great deal of this conflict already, and the big goal is to stop it becoming worse.
Perhaps in the last few minutes we have here, we probably have 3-4 minutes or so, 5 minutes. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit specifically about Europe and about their growth of Islam, what that means for Christianity, and perhaps also looking at that same question about the possibility of serious conflict between Christians and Muslims in Europe, because right. here we have a place where Christianity seems to be, I'm not sure what the right word to use is. Here, at least, it's one of the places where it's not growing dramatically, and
right.
you could see real possibility for competition and conflict between the two faiths as the numbers of Muslims in Europe grow.
Right. Yeah, I talk about this in this book, God's Continent, I published recently. A couple of points about that. A lot of people are very concerned about the growth of Islam in Europe. It's important to get the numbers in context. By American standards, the Muslim minority in Europe is not very large. It's about 4%. You know, if you go to an American city and you have a 4% minority, then basically you think of that pretty much as a white area. So the numbers are not large. That proportion will grow somewhat, but already Muslim birth rates are slowing down quite a lot. They're becoming much more European. Most Muslim countries around the Mediterranean, for instance, currently have lower birth rates than the United States, and that's also true of communities in Europe. Mainstream institutional Christianity in Europe is in a pretty sick condition. It's lost a huge amount of its support, but there's a lot of continuing interest in spirituality, in Christianity. One point I make, for instance, is that we today presently live in the golden age of European pilgrimage. A lot of people are going to Catholic shrines, shrines of the Virgin Mary. So Christianity is not dead. I think it's adapting to new forms. Maybe it's evolving away from old institutional forms. So I don't underrate the threat of, you know, terrorism, unrest, conflict, but I think we should put it in proportion.
Yeah, I think that there's an interesting point here that you make, too. You know, we were talking earlier about the dramatic growth in the numbers of Christians in Latin America and in Africa, and what that perhaps means for Christianity worldwide. Here also, it is the case that it's not just the case that these African Christians are staying in Africa. Some of them are going to Europe, and they're moving out into other places, and that they're bringing that kind of faith with them. So we are now starting to see growing numbers, you know, significant communities of Christians of the global South, put that in quotes, in Europe. And one wonders exactly what that is going to mean for European Christianity.
Well, on a typical Sunday already, half the Christians worshiping in London are African or Afro-Caribbean. You know, I quote the phrase, the Empire Strikes Back. The four largest mega churches in Britain are pastored by Africans. And you get these Nigerian and Congolese churches all over Europe. It's a very big presence already. I think that's a, you know, enormously important development. You've got these Nigerian denominations like the Redeemed Christian Church of God, which you'll also find all over the United States. In the past, we were used to missionary activity from the global north to the south. Now it's from the south to the north. Largest Christian congregation in Europe is in Kiev in the Ukraine, and it was founded by Nigerians. Presently, that has 30,000 members. So there are some remarkable stories to be told there.
Yeah. We have a couple of callers here. We'll try to get at least one in the time that remains. This is Champagne and Line 1. Hello.
Hello. You're speaking of Christianity as it's gone through Europe. As far as I could tell, Christianity through Europe has been a devastatingly horrible thing, where, for example, the 30 Years' War of exterminating Catholics in the Scandinavian countries. As recently as 1910, when the Dukhobors came from the Ukraine and Russia into Canada and spent their time blowing each other up, and then if you go into old history, the Crusades, which were, as far as I could tell, simply population controls in the European countries, to get most of the young men out of the country?
Boy, answering that question in a very short time would be tough, but let me just say there are all sorts of blemishes you can point to, but also basically all European ideas of philosophy, culture, and especially human rights and liberties grow out of Christianity. By the way, you mentioned the Crusades, which were, of course, an attempt by Christians to regain the Near East. Don't forget, those countries were originally Christian countries. They still had very, very large Christian populations at the time, and the Muslims had conquered them a couple of hundred years earlier. Fighting for religion is never a very good idea, but I think it's always important to share the blame equally. There were a great many religious wars between Muslims and Christians, and it's very hard to put the blame firmly on either one side.
We must stop there because we are here at the end of the time. If you'd like to read more from our guest, you might look at his most recent book, God's Continent, Christianity, Islam, and Europe's Religious Crisis. That's just recently published, Oxford University Press. And then also the book that we've talked about here mostly through this hour, this book, The Next Christendom, revised and expanded edition, The Coming of Global Christianity is the subtitle. That's also published by the Oxford University Press by our guest, Philip Jenkins. He is Distinguished Professor of History and Religious Studies at Penn State University. Professor Jenkins, thank you very much.
And thank you very much.